separate people.
You get the background.
You get a background check.
Hi, everybody.
Hi.
My name is Fleeta, and I'm an alcoholic. And of course, I have the willies just being here, you know. Naturally, that's, you know, a part of what we do is to say yes when we're asked to share at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I tried to wiggle out of this one. Actually, I did. Didn't I, Kim? She emailed me, and I had a couple of reasons that I thought were super valid, you know, saying that I had shared a couple of times recently, which is actually true, and that I didn't want it to be overkill, so in case somebody had heard me. But really, I mean, the 49ers were on this afternoon, and that's what I wanted to do. So I'm just telling that to pull my own covers and to be in the truth of it. Because I love sports, and, you know, I love basketball, and I love football, and I love watching. So, but, you know, I was thinking a lot about what I was going to say here today, and I have absolutely no idea, which is the truth. And I think that's always the way it is when, you know, when you come to share in these meetings. I have been sober quite a long time. And I've been sober for 38 years, and I was thinking about why I still come to these meetings, and I even was thinking maybe AI could do this chat for me, you know. But then I thought, you know, I have alcoholism, not alcoholism. So I know we've all heard that, but that is why I still go to meetings, and that is what I'm doing here today. And I really said the prayer of, you know, I hope I can help somebody today. I hope somebody can hear something that's helpful. So, you know, luckily I don't have to reinvent the wheel. There's a formula. What it was like, what happened, what it's like today. We share our experience, strength, and hope. So I, you know, we'll start with, you know, growing up, I was a part of a very large family. There were 7 children and 2 alcoholic parents. And my parents were alcoholic for as long as I can remember, from when I was a very young kid. My parents got married in their 20s. I think they were 20 years old, 20, and got married in 1950. So, and then they were popping out kids right and left. So they were kids when we were kids. And it was a lot of fun, in a big way, it was a lot of fun to grow up with a lot of people and a lot of support. And in another way, you know, it's harrowing too. So I look back now. I used to make a lot of jokes about my family and my siblings, but really, I've lost 2 siblings really to this disease. So it's not as funny as it was. But I do have only 1 other sister that's in recovery, and I have 1 sister that just doesn't drink at all and never really has. But other than that, all 7 of us basically were alcoholic, you know, or just wreaking a lot of havoc on the planet one way or another. When I was growing up, I think, you know, my mom and dad, my dad was like Fred Flintstone or that guy from The Honeymooners, you know. I mean, he was just like all in and ready to go. And my mom was like Morticia Adams. She was depressed. She was what they called back then manic depressive. So, but, you know, you don't know that when you're a kid, you know, but I mean, things like this would happen. So I would say I can remember maybe 2nd grade, maybe 1st grade. My mother arrived in the classroom with no shoes, barefoot, and, you know, barefoot completely, no advance notice, but with popsicles for everybody. Popsicles. And this was a Catholic school. I went to Catholic school. So, I mean, the nuns were like appalled. And I was appalled too, because in the 1950s, you know, people ironed their sheets. You know, everything was buttoned up. You know, nothing happened spontaneously. Like, most kids would think, oh, this is really cool, you know. But it wasn't really cool, you know, even though we enjoyed it, even though everybody had their popsicle. But, you know, and being in Catholic school, you know, there was a lot of tyranny there, just, you know, very rigid. You know, I can remember one day, you know, we had our class physicals, and the nurse came into the classroom and made all the boys stand up and turn to the back of the room. And then she held up a slip, and she asked if this belonged to any of the girls. And I looked under my skirt to... and. And I mean, I remember being walked down to the principal's office, you know, knuckles out, you know, boom. So, you know, I mean, there's a lot of strictness in a Catholic upbringing. We, of course, you know, what we would do is, you know, we'd go to church, we'd always be, you know, we'd get there right before communion and we'd leave right after. And we couldn't sneak in. There's nine of us. So, but then we'd go to the beach or something fun, you know. I mean, I will say, you know, my dad, who was, you know, again, a little bit of a, you know, a little bit more easygoing, he was a pass out drunk. My mom was a blackout drunk. And so pass out, he's there on the couch. Blackout, up and running. You know, I was a blackout drunk, basically. You know, I was a full, you know, people like to say they're a garden variety alcoholic. I was like, no, I was a black belt. You know, I basically was a total blackout drunk. But my, you know, with my mom, I can remember times where, you know, she'd take off for a few days. And I remember the police coming to our house. And I had to go get my dad. Like it was in the middle of winter, and I remember the police were at the door, and we were in this great big house that my parents were renting. You know, it had actually a slide in the playroom that went down to another story. I mean, and we were just running wild, doing what we wanted to do. But I went to get my dad, and I couldn't open his eyes. You know, you do that thing when you're a kid or you're trying to open somebody's eye. Like, he was so passed out that I couldn't get his eyes open. And so I went and got the police officer, and he went up, you know, to the bedroom, and, you know, he woke my dad up. And my mom had been, you know, picked up in New York City, barefoot again. She was like a barefoot girl, barefoot in the snow with $3,000 in her purse. So they put her in the flight deck at Bellevue. But none of this stuff fazed any of us. You know, on we went. She eventually got out. You know, my dad talked to the police officer. You know, there was like a little like, oh, maybe something's got to change. But, you know, no effort to actually make that happen. Another time, I remember my mom and dad came to our school. I was basically in sixth grade when this happened. And they got all of us kids rounded up and put us in the car and decided we were going to go to the World's Fair in Canada. So off we went to the World's Fair in Canada, you know, for a week. Yeah, I mean, again, nothing packed. And I mean, they had packed a few things. My dad was always doing these schemes, like working for a toy company or whatever, working for these crazy companies. Anyway, he had these styrofoam sleeping bags. Well, we had all these little kids that, you know, still wet their pants and stuff. So here, I mean, it was just a nightmare in this, and, you know, anyway, off we went. And I remember we were in Canada, and there they have imperial courts, and my, you know, like a regular court of booze, and then an imperial court. Well, my mother, my dad kept buying himself. He drank scotch, she drank vodka. He'd buy himself the imperial court, and my mom would just get the regular size court. And she would be livid. I mean, seriously, she'd be absolutely furious. Of course, we were camping. We weren't staying in hotels. So it was, you know, I mean, we were staying in these bizarre places. And my mother, you know, she'd still get wasted, and she set all of our shoes on fire. We went through that whole vacation with no shoes. And she even fell, I mean, another time, like, she walked off this cliff. But, you know, as alcoholics do, you know, she walked off this cliff in Canada, I mean, and, you know, with her drink in her hand, and, you know, boom, bada boom, bada boom, but at the bottom of the hill, there she is, you know, not a drop is spilled, you know, I mean, and we're just all looking over, you know. Anyway, you know, yeah, it was crazy. Up she climbed. At the end of that vacation, my parents didn't have a penny, and I remember my dad had to contact someone he went to college with and borrow $20, and we drove through McDonald's. Okay, you know, I mean, I was talking to my sister, telling her I had to do this, and she said to me, oh, don't forget to tell him about the time we were at the diner, and Dad fell asleep in the bowl of soup, and we couldn't wake him up. And that was probably like after church, we went to a diner, and, you know, and he crashed into the bowl of soup. But, you know, one of the things I vividly remember, like, as a kid was being in the car, and then I'll move on. But I just think this contributed to my chaos and my shame, really. But I remember being in the car, and there we had one of these vans, one of these big vans that, you know, all of us were in. It was probably one of the first ones made. We had the first double stroller ever made either. Think about that. I mean, my mom was pushing two kids in a stroller, in the double stroller, pulling a baby carriage, and she was pregnant. 1950s. So, anyway, no wonder they were nuts, you know. But I remember we'd all get in the car, you know, there was no seat belts or anything. I mean, if anything, the little kids had one of those little seats that went over the back and had a horn, and that was like our safety mechanism, right? Or this, you know, you come to this stop and it was this. Anyway, you know, we'd all be in the car driving, and of course, you know, my dad would always go to the soda shop once a week, so we had all these bottles in the car, these bottles that would rattle around in this tin van. But anyway, we'd go this way and that way and this way and that way. And one day the door flew open and like a kid rolled out, and you know, my dad just turns around, knock it off back there, you know, get back in again and knock that off, you know. So, you know, it's just not a big deal, all that stuff. And on we went. Kid rolls out of the car, no problem. One of my sisters actually got lost in the next town, and the police picked her up. And she was only two. And, I mean, we were on a shopping trip for shoes. But anyway, you know, so we're in this town. It'd be like from Benicia to Vallejo. It was that kind of a distance. So she's two and a half. Police officer finds her, and she said, I can't find my family. So he goes, do you know where you live? And she said, yes. And he directed her all the way home from Vallejo to Benicia. So, you know, and then we didn't even know she was missing when they drove up. So, yeah, there you go. But anyway, we made homemade ice cream. You know, we cooked, we had fun. You know, I mean, we lived on Long Island in a little town with very neat yards, you know, like a little suburban town. I always tell this because this is the part of like that as I started to get older, like became very problematic for me. So we lived in a town that looked like the garage threw up on the front yard. I mean, there was bicycles, used cars, lawnmowers, all sorts of stuff. I mean, you know, my dad had tried to build a boat in the house and then he couldn't get it out because, yeah. So, I mean, so we had all the remnants of that. We had, you know, we were right near the beach. So we had boats and motors and sails and, you know, all sorts of stuff. And then, you know, but I'd come home from a babysitting job and the garage door would be open and I'd be like, oh my God, you know, and then, you know, maybe my dad would be there. Maybe he'd be sitting on the lawn, you know, I mean, maybe he'd have like a turban or a towel on his head. I mean, weird stuff, you know, but I just didn't say anything. And most of the people didn't say anything either. So, you know, I mean, my parents didn't even know they were alcoholics. You know, they were just absolutely blind drunk every night and went off and did these things, you know. And it wasn't until I became, you know, a teenager, older, that I felt like, wow, it was really clear that alcohol was the problem here, you know. I knew it, but, you know, but back in the day, you know, it took them a long time. For whatever reason, my father sought recovery first. And I remember that the people from AA used to come to the house and pick them up and take them to a meeting. I mean, I really have to give AA credit. Oh, my God. They were just so incredible, like the 12-stepping that happened back in those days. You know, I can remember, and of course, my dad pulled my mother's cover, so then all the women would be coming. Two vanloads of people would pull up in front of our house. And I can remember my mother running into the closet, and she said she never sweared, ever. She was very religious, very Catholic. You know, we were doing rosaries every night. And I remember she said, don't those fuckers ever stay home? I mean, and I could not believe it. But out they would come. And they would come, you know, the six people would come, and then they would walk each one of them out to a separate car and take them off for a meeting. And, I mean, when they knocked on the door, I pointed to the closet, like, she's in there. Go get her, you know? But anyway, you know, I was, as I became a teenager, I kind of became resentful, you know, of all of their drinking. But I did intuitively know that they were powerless. You don't really know that when you're a kid, though. You think your parents can do everything, you know, that you think they're just so omnipotent. But I will say what happened for me was I just started doing drugs when I was a teenager. That was my, you know, that was my gateway, you know, basically. I would say not heavy drugs. I mean, we did pot and hash and things like that. But once I turned 18, which in New York State at the time, you could drink when you were 18, my brother, who was a wild alcoholic already and just a year ahead of me, I mean, he had already had like hit and runs and, you know, I mean, not where he hurt anybody, but, you know, just where he damaged cars and, you know, crazy things are happening already in his life. But I remember, you know, he took me to a bar. And this would be my first outing. And, you know, I did have one episode when I was 6 years old where I drank. My parents had a cocktail party and they invited everybody. And I drank everybody's leftovers and slept in my toy barrel that night. And it was filled with splinters. It was the worst, you know, it was horrible. When I woke up and I was covered with splinters, it was crazy. But other than that, I didn't drink till I was 18. So I remember I drank whiskey sours, guys, and I ate the cherries. And I remember thinking the next day when I was hurling my guts out, it was the cherries. Yeah, yeah, it was the cherries that did it. But I loved it. I loved the effect of alcohol. And, you know, I feel like I took every drug known to man, I would say, except for birth control, because that wasn't natural, you know. But I washed it all down with alcohol, you know. And I know, you know, I know this is, you know, in this program, we try to really focus on alcohol. I think we're lucky because when you're an alcoholic, it's so obvious, you know. I mean, you're freaking drunk, you know. It's so obvious that you have a problem. I mean, even though obviously we don't see it as alcoholics, and it takes a long, long time, I think, to really concede to our innermost selves that we're alcoholic. I mean, I did not want to give up alcohol because the feeling was so elusive and yummy. And I had all the knowledge you need that alcohol was a problem. I knew. My parents ended up sobering up. They sobered up when I was 20. That was the year I left home. I don't think it's a coincidence, but I mean, I don't think it has anything to do with me leaving home, but that was the year I moved out. And that was the year my dad got sober and my mom got sober the following year, and they died sober in this program. So I knew about this program, and I wish I would give anything to have heard them speak or hear them tell their story. I would love that. My mother always wanted to write this book called Third Base is Dead, because, of course, we had a baseball field in our yard, and third base was a tree that we killed because we'd all swing around it, you know. But I didn't hear them tell their stories because I was busy out there. You know, I was busy drinking and using. My dad gave me a big book once on one of my visits. I took the train. I lived in New York City, and I took the train out to Long Island. And, you know, I was all in my hotsy-totsy outfit or whatever it was. And my dad, you know, gave me a big book, you know, when I was staying at the house. And I said, well, I said, I need a brown bag to put this in. I said, you know, I don't want to be carrying this around, you know. But you know, I would say my own drinking, well, I was a blackout drunk from the moment I drank. So I blacked out that first night, and I was basically a big drinker. I mean, people did other things because that's what we did in the 70s. I discoed my way through all the, you know, poppers and pills and all the things that were out there. But, I mean, my home, you know, the thing that made me feel good was alcohol, you know, even though I think I drank because I was depressed. And there are so many, you know, ironies, you know, that I think, you know, it's a disease of loneliness, so we isolate to cure it, you know, all the things that we do, you know, when we're drinking. But for me, I had a lot of episodes, you know, I'm, you know, drinking before I even got married. I basically was a bar hopper. You know, I felt like that was women's lip. You know, I could go into a bar by myself. You know, I was happy to burn my bra, you know, or whatever it was. You know, it's funny. I didn't have any respect for my body, you know. I didn't have any respect for yours either. You know, I feel like I was very promiscuous. It was just, it was partly the times that I was in. And I mean, and also there was, it felt good. But, you know, I read the 24-hour meditation today, and it's about sex, you know. And I thought, you know, sex needs to be right-sized in sobriety, but it's a part of us, and it's a good thing. I mean, I feel like for me, you know, yeah, when I came to AA, I always say, God, I did not want to hold hands with people. I did have sex on the first date, though. You know, I mean, so, you know, I mean, like, that is like, you know, like, that was the thing that was, you know, incongruous for me. But I was like, no, I don't want to touch your hand or hold hands. I got sober at 1010 Valencia, so that maybe that's a part of it. But, you know, got sober in San Francisco. But what I want to say is, you know, I didn't have respect for myself. I didn't feel good about myself. You know, I remember I jumped out of a taxi in New York once, you know, that was driving, you know. So, you know, I went to a lot of really nasty places and woke up. I mean, the thing is, when you're blackout drunk, everything sounds good when they're presenting it and you're in a blackout. And then the next morning when you wake up and, you know, you have to do that walk of shame home, boy, nothing feels worse. I mean, nothing feels worse than that kind of just pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. And, you know, of course, you know, you still have your outfit on from the night before and normal people are going to work and you smell like old bar and a hoe. I mean, it's bad, right? So, but, you know, that's the thing about being an alcoholic. You know, a minute passes or at least 8 hours passes and it wasn't so bad. You know, whatever horrible memory you had of that moment somehow is not enough to step in the way and say, something's got to give. That's the, is it, what do they say, the peculiar mental twist that occurs before the first drink. You know, we really, I mean, even though I felt terrible about myself, I wasn't happy, I was depressed, I was not really able to have a meaningful relationship. Anyway, you know, life goes on. That was my pattern. It's the same pattern that, you know, we have a spree, we have remorse, rinse and repeat, you know. So at that time, I got a new job. I was getting fired right and left because I was always drinking. I had started off as a secretary when I moved to New York, but then I was always drinking. I changed to being a waitress and I worked in nightclubs and bars. And I was always, you know, the only drink on my tray was my own. I would be like, get your own drink. This is mine. So, you know, but I ended up working in this bar and I met a bartender and we got married. I mean, you know, we dated really. I think I got the job in July and we married in September. So, but, you know, what I want to say is in a way, it felt kind of organic, like we were from the same tribe. Obviously, you know, we didn't know each other, of course. And, you know, but, you know, that's what crazy people do and alcoholics do. And obviously he had his own things too. You know, he had his own addictions and other things. But, you know, I loved being married to a bartender because I could go there every night. He was working, give me a few drinks, see you later. You know, so, I mean, it worked out well. And I highly recommend it if you're still out there practicing, you know. But I will say that he had a drug problem is what happened was, and this was a part of the 70s too. He had a really bad, he had a nose like a horse. I mean, seriously, you know, I mean, he snorted up so much cocaine. And so I did that with him too. And, you know, I mean, but so we did have a lot of problems. I remember being so paranoid that I couldn't walk our dog. I remember looking out, you know, my apartment, trying to see. And then I remember putting an outfit on my dog, like a sweater or something. This is before everybody put a sweater on their dog. Now it's, but I remember I was trying to disguise us, you know, like the people in our building wouldn't know who we were. Like we made more noise in that building because, you know, we fought and we yelled, we'd make up and, you know, anyway, you know, what happened is we were married for quite some time, but after a certain period of time, we decided to make this big geographic out here. And at the time, I thought, oh, this is good, even though I didn't really, you know, understand why we were leaving New York. You know, I didn't really think it through. I just like, he had this disease of there's no place like someplace else. And I just went along to go along, you know, whatever he wanted to do, you know, sure. I was the wife. I just didn't really put up a fight about things. So we get out here and, you know, a minute later, he found a cocaine connection. And I remember locking him out of our house. We were living on 17th Street in San Francisco. And I remember he was running around the house, like in these big circles. And I just had this like little moment of clarity, like, oh man, wherever you go, there you are, you know? So, I decided, and he encouraged me because, that's what I'm saying. He wasn't the drunk. You know, with cocaine, you kind of look a little normal until you don't. But, I mean, it's much easier to hide. But, I mean, I was drunk every night. You know, I was falling down drunk every night. So we decided I should go to AA. So I did. I walked to the doors of AA and I sat there and I remember, okay, you know, I was at 1010 Valencia Street, which was relatively near where we lived, and there was smoking in the meetings, and it looked like, wow, it looked horrible to me, you know, it really did. I was like, I just felt like so alone in a room full of people that probably had the same problem I did, you know. But I didn't believe it, you know. I didn't believe it. I couldn't stand the old timers. I thought they were so smug, and who cares if they ever drank because it was so long ago. And that's really why it was really important for me to actually connect with the people that were sober a minute. Like when somebody had 24 hours, I was like, oh, I want what you have. You know, I do think that I really aligned myself with a lot of people that were just newly sober. And we went to meetings together and we had this frothy passion for, like, attack that newcomer. You know, we'd run over and we'd say hello to a newcomer. I mean, you know, and surround them. And, you know, we had this old car that we drove around in that was like, it looked like a 1950s car, like one of those station wagons that was like, it looked like a building that had tipped over. You know, it was this big giant car and we plastered it with like bumper stickers. The big book says it and I believe it, you know. And we all got these earrings from American Airlines that were AA, and we were running around with these AA earrings, and we were just nuts. But we had fun, you know. And honestly, that was really important to me. Like, the thing is, I did enjoy my drinking when I was doing it, in the beginning especially. And I didn't care that I didn't respect my body or respect my mind or respect yours. What I really, really, you know, I thought I was having fun. And there was a time when it was fun. So it was really important to me when I got to AA to see people enjoying their lives, enjoying, you know, their sobriety, having fun, having laughs. Being together in a way that letting people know them. I do feel, you know, like the very first 30 meetings I attended, gratitude was the topic. And I was like, oh my God, don't these people ever talk about sex or money? You know, I was like, what is wrong here? You know, I just couldn't believe it. But, you know, and that's because when you first come to AA, a language is spoken that you don't speak. You do not understand. When somebody says incomprehensible demoralization, it's like, psh. When somebody read the promises, I was like, look, I just want a new pair of boots. I don't want any, I don't care about all that, you know? When I went to, I remember going to one of the early churches, looking around like, hey, do they have any cool candlesticks here that I could, you know, avail myself of? I was like, you know, that's how we get what we want when we're drinking, you know. I'd be happy to open your medicine cabinet and see if you had any Quaaludes or anything. But I ended up right away, I got involved right away. And, you know, I hung with, what do they say, hang with the winners, you know, that's what I did. And I went to a meeting every day, probably for 90 days when I first sobered up. So my husband wasn't getting sober at this point. And, you know, he did tell me later that he felt like I had replaced him, you know, and that all these people that were helping me and become my new friends. And there's probably a part of that that's true. The first woman who sponsored me, I she recently reached out to me through Instagram. But anyway, she would volunteer to come. I lived out far from the center of the city, and she would say she'd come pick me up, and I would be like, okay. You know, meanwhile, I thought, oh my God, this poor thing must have nothing to do. You know, I thought I was doing her a favor. You know, like, I didn't really want to go to one of these meetings, but because she's coming all the way out here to get me, I can't really say no, you know? And I thought, you know, I'd get in her car, she had a Volkswagen, she had this crazy big German Shepherd that was like drooling down my neck. Yeah, and she called him Bigelow. And I was like, oh my God. But You know what? We did the steps together. We did all of the steps together. So, and I remember, you know, when we did the third step, you know, we sat down. First of all, of course, I had a hard time in, you know, thinking about a higher power. I'm like, oh, brother. You know, because I'd come from that religious background that was very strict. But, you know, it was actually easy for me to make a leap into a spiritual realm, you know. So, you know, when we did the steps and, you know, all that's required is a little bit of willingness to believe in God, or I say God, but I mean higher power, basically, you know, because I'm not a Christian in the regular sense, you know. I mean, I don't have any issues with it at all. God bless you guys. I'm grateful for churches everywhere because they keep AA rolling. And but I just, what I, you know, what happened for me was I met another person after this person. This person, we went through all the steps. We did the writing. You know, I repeated my fifth step to her, which, you know, I think, you know, in this program, you know, what do here? We come to believe, you know, we admit we're powerless. We take a moral inventory of ourselves. We admit our defects of character to somebody live, not just, you know, to ourselves in a room. No, it requires a person. And then we try to make amends to the people we harmed. And then we go and talk to other people. It's really simple. Ha, ha, ha. But, you know, it is. I mean, I think I made that. I did my four step to the best of my ability at that time. I read it to her. It was great. I felt so good afterwards. I went home. I sat with myself. I really thought I didn't leave anything out. I really talked about some ugly resentments that I had. And, you know, it felt... and then I did the seven-step prayer and asked God to remove my defects of character, which he is still working on, by the way. So I will say, I didn't have that immediate spiritual experience like people talk about a burning bush or whatever. The only burning bush was mine. I didn't have any, you know, I did not have that immediate freedom from, you know, from my doubt, from my skepticism, from my intellect that made me not want to believe in God or not want to believe in, you know, higher power. So it's taken time, you know, and I still have my defects of character. I'm still a smart ass. I remember my dad always used to say to me, nobody likes a smart ass. And I'm like, well, you're stuck with one, you know. But, you know, what I think is over time, you know, the steps became rooted in me. And that's what happens. That's why you have to keep coming. I mean, AA is so incredible in that way because we talk about the same stuff over and over, don't we? We really do. That's because it's in one ear and out the other. You know, that's the way it all is. But stuff does sift through and sit in our hearts. I think, you know... I think about, you know, what happened after that was, you know, I did meet another woman, a woman that, you know, so I was still relatively newly sober that became my friend and eventually my sponsor. And so 38 years later, she's still my person. And so, you know, we basically grew up together in AA. We raised our families. We had our divorces. I mean, not at the same time, but I will say she was somebody that I got to share my recovery with, and we ended up doing, you know, we sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact. We ended up doing a lot of spiritual things, like different things. We went to hear Wayne Dyer and Marianne Williamson and Louise Hay and all, you know, all sorts of other healers, and we did timeline therapy and NLP and this and that. And we did a lot of different things. But, you know, for me, you know, I mean, I still feel like the core for me is rooted right here. You know, if I didn't have this, I couldn't have done any of that. Even though all of that has helped me, and I feel like that has made me a far more spiritual person than I was when I was like, you know, I remember when I was a kid, I used to like do all these like weird gyrations to try to, you know, be a martyr and offer myself up. Like I'd put a tack down and then I'd kneel on it and try to say a prayer, you know, to help my parents, as if that is going to lift them into sobriety or help my siblings. So I felt like a kind of old religion wasn't working for me. And I want to say, you know, for me, this is a spiritual program, and you do need to have that psychic shift, you know, that happens. So, I feel like having that psychic change, that's happened for me. You know, and I don't really know what that is. That's like a change in your soul. I mean, it's not like you can do heart surgery, and we all know what the heart is, but soul surgery, I feel like that's what happens when you work the steps with another alcoholic. And that's really what we do here is, like, we want to do it alone. I guarantee you, if I could have done it alone, see you later, people. You know, I would have. I would not have come here. I mean, it's hard to ask for help. I think asking for help is one of the best tenets that we have, one of the best slogans that we have, because it means you're not giving up. It means that you're saying, I'm willing to struggle. I'll struggle with somebody. Here's my struggle. So I think asking for help is really, really powerful. All the good stuff I know I learned here, guys, all of it, you know. I love the stories. I love hearing other people's war stories. I love laughing. I love laughing about some of the most horrible stuff, you know, that happens to us. I mean, I've heard everybody, you know, confess everything from a murder to a rape, you know. So, you know, I'm not laughing about that, but I'm just saying it's, you know, there's nothing you can bring to this room that somebody else hasn't heard or done. So, I mean, I think it's a really powerful program. And I think, you know, just a few things, and then I'm going to close because I'm a fast talker, so it's an hour's worth, you know, even though I want to say that the phenomena of craving, that is a real thing, guys. So I know that, like, if you're an alcoholic, you know, this will happen for you. You will have a craving now and then. I feel like if you do the work, you know, that is what gets lifted. You know, that crazy stuff. But that's the thing is, when you don't want to do the work or you don't want to be here, you know, even if you don't want to be here and you're here, that's a start. That's what I think. Just a thimbleful of willingness is enough to make a start. That's what I always kind of got objected when people were like, you need to do this and you need to take the cotton out of your mouth or out of your ears and shove it in your mouth. I'm like, but I know that those people meant well and were doing the best they could. But I think, you know, like tenderness and kindness, that's what worked for me. You know, when somebody said, oh, my God, you're in the right place and you never have to drink again. Well, I didn't even know if I wanted that. I just wanted to, you know, like, not swing from the chandeliers so much, you know. But I didn't know that I didn't really want to drink anymore. But what I realized is that there, once you've become the pickle, you're not going to be a cucumber again. So, and I think I've learned here not to be selfish, not to be self-centered, which is not 100%. I still work on that every day. I've learned about humility. I've learned about not judging people. You know, I mean, it's really easy to judge everybody. I feel like if you've got somebody next to you, in front of you, or in back of you, just know that they've had trauma. But, like, we don't know what everybody's trauma is. But they may not be alcoholic, but they're screwed up. Everybody is. That's what life is. You know, life is a big, wonderful mystery, and it's getting over obstacles, you know? So I am, you know, I'm sober today, I'm healthy. I mean, nothing has meant more to me than my health. And I couldn't have cared less about my health. I drank and ate like a sailor. I mean, I really couldn't have given a hoot about my health when I was younger. I didn't exercise, nor did I even want to hear about it. You know, I really loved drinking because I felt like it kept me trim. You know, I would rather eat, I would rather drink than eat. So anyway, guys, you know, I want to say that getting a person to help you through the steps, that's the key to this program, you know. Finding a higher power and living by spiritual guides, that's really the answer to it all. I want to say I'm so grateful that you guys came today, and I'm grateful that I came, and I love you guys, I really do. I mean, there's people here that I've known a whole long time, and You know, sometimes I like to hide out, even in AA, but, you know, I know that I never feel better than when I'm in a room of other alcoholics. So, okay, everybody, I think that's going to be it for me today. Thank you.
Another hand for Fleeta.
Do you collect that?
Oh. That's for the basket. Okay, thanks. Great. Thank you all for coming. There'll be an email and another notice for next month. We'll see what we're going to do. We're not sure yet. So
January.
Thank you.
January.
Yeah.
And please take some of the food home.
Yeah.
Yeah, take the food home.
Help yourself.
So crazy.